Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I don't know if you've heard this yet, especially if you're not in California, but California is exploring the question of reparations. A task force will make recommendations next year to Governor Gavin Newsom on a plan to compensate African American state residents for the economic legacy of slavery and racism. It'll be up to lawmakers in the state to act on those recommendations, but just the fact that they're looking at them with an official group is a big first step. So we'll talk now about the task force's work so far and why California, which only gained statehood about 10 years before the start of the Civil War and wasn't officially a slave state, is even considering reparations for slavery and leading the way in a certain respect on that. And we'll talk about how much of the state's resources would even begin to feel like historical redress. Joining me now is Curtis Lee, Los Angeles-based economics correspondent for The New York Times. Curtis, thanks for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
So who's on the reparations task force, and what has Governor Gavin Newsom asked them to determine?
Yeah, so the reparations task force here in California, I think we should first step back, obviously, to 2020. After the murder of George Floyd, we saw a lot of social justice protests around this country. We saw a lot of companies, colleges, city and state leaders calling for racial justice. And, lawmakers in Sacramento passed a bill that basically would create a 9-member task force to explore reparations in the state of California for African Americans and Black citizens, obviously. So, it's a mix of people on this task force. You have politicians, you have academics, you also have lawyers and historians and people who just really have obviously studied reparations, the history of this country. And basically, they've been just really exploring reparations and traveling the state, hearing from residents who have suffered from discrimination, whose families, might have lost land here in California due to racist policies. And they've been holding these town hall style meetings, from San Francisco to Los Angeles and Oakland, really hearing from the community, hearing from residents, and really, coming up with an idea of what reparations could possibly even look like in the state of California before they then move it on to a final report they will pass along to lawmakers in Sacramento to basically come up with a concrete plan that the legislature would eventually have to pass.
Have you been to any of these town halls as a reporter and heard any individual stories? Maybe pass one example along here, because we can talk about, slavery and the horrors of slavery and how the economics of slavery affect people to this day, sort of in the abstract. But when we hear a person's story, sometimes it hits home in a different way. So do you wake up at night thinking about any of them?
Yeah, of course. I went to a meeting here in Los Angeles in September. And I mean, you hear these terrible, tragic stories of loss of people who are just really sitting with a lot of pain. Black folks sitting with a lot of pain in this state. And, reading the report, the committee came out with an initial report this summer that really outlined some of the tragedies of slavery and racism here in this state. A lot of, enslaved Black people were brought to California during the Gold Rush era. The report gets into how redlining and obviously, racially restrictive covenants had segregated Black Californians in some of the state's biggest cities. And, when you look at what happened in the Western Addition in San Francisco, the Fillmore District, I mean, this is a vibrant Black neighborhood in San Francisco. And I mean, this was kind of the Harlem of the West, they called it in a lot of ways. And city officials had designated this area a blight eventually in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And, a lot of homes were taken, demolished. A lot of Black-owned businesses were demolished and people were pushed out of San Francisco, Black people. And, what really also stuck with me was the story of Russell City, California. It's this community in the East Bay and in the Oakland, Alameda County area. And, this was a community that was a vibrant Black community where people through the, fleeing the Deep South during the Great Migration, heading west to Los Angeles and Oakland in the Bay Area, settled in the city of this little community, Russell City. And it was an unincorporated part of Alameda County. And basically this, you know, the county eventually designated this area a blight. They said that this is, you know, there wasn't running water, there wasn't reliable electricity, but it was home for a lot of people. You know, it was a vibrant community. There was blues clubs. There were, you know, a lot of people sitting on porches reminiscing about their lives that they had fled in the South, and now their new work that they were doing in shipyards in the West. And, you know, eventually, you know, county officials said this was a blight. People need to leave, and they started seizing a lot of properties through eminent domain. And people, you know, who had paid, you know, decent money, you know, back in the 50s, 60s for their homes were given, you know, nearly a fraction of what they had paid and forced to move. And a lot of people were relocated into parts of Oakland, into Hayward, and further outside in the Bay Area. So, you know, just hearing the stories of tragedy, of loss, of generational wealth lost, right? I mean, when you look at the median wealth of Black households in the United States, you know, it's $24,100 compared to, you know, $188,200 for white households. And I mean, when you really talk about generational wealth and you look at the history of racism in this country, I mean, it really has a lasting legacy. And I heard that through those stories in Russell City when I talked to people.
Thank you for those examples. So California listeners, if you're up early and listening to Right Coast Radio, our lines are open for you. What should your state take into account as it considers the question of reparations, or anyone else, because this really is a national question. It's just that California has impaneled this task force now. What should the country take into account as it considers the question of reparations? What could any state at the state level, even a state as huge as California, so much bigger than any other state in this country with 40 million people, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer with Curtis Lee from the New York Times, who's covering this as an LA correspondent. So how does the task force think reparations would be distributed, and how has the task force, if they've gotten this far yet, suggested that it would determine eligibility?
Yeah, so the task force is looking at a number of ways, you know, that reparations could be implemented. And I should note that, you know, obviously California is the first state in this country to do something like this, to create a reparations task force. This has not happened at the federal level in Congress. You know, for almost 30 years, John Conyers, the former representative from Michigan, was really, you know, pushing this bill called H.R. 40 that would essentially create a federal task force to explore reparations. And, you know, since Conyers retired and obviously passed away, Sheila Jackson Lee in Texas has taken over this legislation in Congress. It said it passed out of committee for the first time in 2021, but eventually stalled on the floor of the House. And again, so California is very, very much the first state to do this. But, you know, they've also looked at other examples of what cities have done. Evanston, Illinois.
Can I jump in on that for just a second,
yeah,
the Congress piece?
Of course.
Because even with a Democratic Congress the last few years, they couldn't get this bill, this famous Conyers bill, which we've talked about on the show. Unfortunately, we never had him during his lifetime. But it wasn't going to commit anybody to anything. It was just going to study the question. And they couldn't get that through a Democratic Congress?
Yeah, and that there was a lot of pressure, obviously, from, you know, groups like the NAACP, really calling for, you know, Congress to step up. And yeah, you're absolutely right. After the momentum that was felt, right, after 2020, after George Floyd's murder, after this, you know, quote unquote racial reckoning that this country was having, you know, even Democrats, you know, were really pressed on this issue. And you see people like Cory Booker, who was very vocal, you know, in support of this measure, you know, speaking to the White House, to the Biden administration. And, you know, there was movement, though, right? Like it passed out of committee for the first time, but eventually it did stall. Absolutely. Even with Democrats in power, it's been tough to get this bill passed. And obviously then California kind of has essentially replicated what H.R. 40 is on the federal level, basically at the state level here in California.
And you were starting to say before I so rudely interrupted that there are some smaller examples out there, like at the city
level? You see it in Evanston, Illinois recently. Officials there passed approved $10 million in the form of housing grants to be doled out in terms of reparations. Also in Asheville, North Carolina, city leaders have committed $2.1 million toward reparations. And these are obviously smaller, you know, places, you know, cities, and it's nowhere near the level of the state of California. But back to the task force in California, they're looking at a number of ways to implement reparations. You know, this could be also through housing grants. It could be through direct cash payments to residents. But again, a lot of this is up in the air in terms of like what the legislature does with these recommendations that are given to them next year from this task force. And, you know, is there the political will to do anything? Will they move ahead and actually make any sort of concrete past legislation that offers concrete, you know, payments to Black residents? It's still all very much up in the air.
Interesting. And I guess what kinds of forms it would take, is a fascinating, rich topic of conversation. For example, Cory Booker, who you mentioned, some of the listeners may know that he's kind of famous in this arena for his baby bonds proposal, right? Which is for basically every baby in the United States, regardless of race, to be given a certain amount of bond credit or whatever you'd call it that would mature when they get to be 18 or so. So they would have this, so there would be equality in, let's say, the ability to afford to go to college, which so distributes by race in this country, you know, because of the legacy of discrimination in this country. That's an example, right? I don't know if I got all the details exactly right, but that kind of thing with Cory Booker's baby bonds.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, in terms of Booker, he's been a vocal supporter of the, you know, reparations. And I mean, he's obviously, like you said, been out there with his effort for baby bonds. It's certainly what, and also lawmakers, people I talk to here in California, they want to see this as kind of this catalyst to really, you know, spark a fire under other states as well, possibly, you know, lawmakers in Albany and in New York looking at something similar to what California is doing. So they really want to use this as a catalyst to, you know, and create this dialogue in this country, right? And not just like, you know, let the events of, you know, what occurred in 2020 after George Floyd and, you know, kind of dissipate. They really want to, you know, create a catalyst for this to move on, for there to really truly be some sort of racial justice in this country in these years ahead.
TK in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, TK.
40 years ago, my grandmother left the Bronx and moved to San Francisco. She had a nice home in the Bay Area. I was about 10 years old. I can remember the whole neighborhood, Black. The whole neighborhood. We could go out on the porch. I could see the Golden Gate Bridge from my grandmother's porch. 20 years after that, she said, "We got to go." We were told we got to go. And I said, "Grandma, who told you got to go?" And she said, "The people over here are saying we can't stay here. And they keep raising up my taxes. They keep raising up everything, my water. I can't stay here." And she moved from there to Georgia. And she ended up passing away in Georgia. And if I go to that same neighborhood now that I grew up in then, there's not one Black family in that neighborhood. And that neighborhood was all Black. Oh, so they have moved us all over this country and taken away houses time after time. We build it, and for some reason, it gets taken away time after time after time. So that's my story, Brian.
TK, thank you for sharing it, and keep calling us. And in fact, Curtis, if I'm seeing it right, on housing discrimination specifically, and you can hear the sort of multi-generational emotion in TK's voice, right? But on housing discrimination specifically, you write in your Times article, the California Task Force estimates compensation of around $569 billion. Do I have that right? And that's just for the years between 1933 and 1977. So how did it arrive at that figure?
Absolutely. That's, you know, that's been in these discussions that that the panel has been having with economists and different experts on reparations. And, you know, California, like you said, has nearly 39 million people. Nearly 6.5% of California residents are Black. That's around, you know, 2.5 million people who identify as Black or African-American here in the state. And yeah, I mean, these are all preliminary figures, right? So, like, this is, these are just kind of in the discussions and estimations of, like, what it would cost just for this one area. I mean, this task force has identified several areas so far where they would look at, you know, implementing reparations. And that number in this area can rise, it can be reduced. But some of the areas they're looking at are obviously housing discrimination, mass incarceration, unjust property seizures, the devaluation of Black businesses, healthcare. So, yeah, like you said, like there is this number that's being, you know, floated out there, the $569 billion. But again, this is all very much just in discussion, in the form of discussions. The task force has not officially recommended any of this. All of that, you know, will continue to be hashed out in a final report that will be released in 2023. And then it would be on lawmakers in Sacramento to pass or not pass different forms of reparations in the state.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio and live streaming at WNYC.org. Few more minutes with Curtis Lee, New York Times correspondent in Los Angeles, who has an article about the first in the nation state-level reparations task force studying the idea of reparations for 400 years of slavery and other racism at the state level in California, that's going to report back to Governor Newsom and the state legislature there next year, and is possibly setting a model for what may be taken up next in other states. And let's take another call. Beverly in Savannah, Georgia. You're on WNYC. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show. I basically have been listening to these arguments for quite some time now, and horrified at the unfortunate situation that we're in, to have to be dealing with the very same sick system that caused the atrocities and is perpetuating the atrocities. And I think it's very important, obviously, to deal with the after effects and the reforms. But those cash payments should be made according to what was owed the ancestors of Black people. The slaves were owed for their labor, and their descendants should definitely be paid in cash. And the reforms are necessary, but they should be separate. Otherwise, we'd just be perpetuating the situation where we're infantilizing a segment of our population and pretending that they're not entitled to spend what's owed to them, to spend the legacy of their ancestors as they see fit. The reforms for the society have to be separate.
Are you saying the reparations should be limited, because some people say this, to actual descendants of actual American slaves?
No, I'm saying that reparations as a term has been muddied over all this time. Obviously, the descendants of those slaves are owed their legacy. And because all of these atrocities have been perpetuated through our society, there have to be reforms.
Right, I see. So you're saying baby bonds are not enough, civil rights laws are not enough, the actual cash that in effect has been stolen with the interest taken into account should be returned.
Absolutely. Else we're just not getting to the root cause. Else we're implying that Black people aren't entitled to what's owed to them. Else we're implying that people have to spend their money for them because they just can't do it for themselves. Mm-hmm. The reforms are necessary for the society, obviously, when you let a problem fester for centuries, obviously reforms are necessary, but the reforms alone are not sufficient.
Beverly,
and frankly, I believe blacks should be tax exempt as well.
Should we? Sorry, you broke up there. The last thing you said was you also believe what?
I believe that descendants of actually blacks should be tax exempt as well. It's a combat pay. The American society, whether people are ready to admit it or not, is a gauntlet for black citizens. And I think we need to be protected, much the way endangered species should be protected. We're not getting to the point. I know that politicians want to do the most that they think can be agreed upon, but we're just pushing, we're just kicking the can down the road if we don't pay those reparations, reparations for the actual slavery to the actual descendants.
Beverly, thank you. Thank you so much. Please call us again. Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. I'm a little hoarse. I apologize. I think we have to do with this something alike to what we need to do with COP27. The funds for loss and damage, not just focus on who is entitled to be compensated, but focusing the source of payments on those most responsible. Because if we only talk about general revenues funding these compensation funds, you're going to scare away many low and moderate income whites who would otherwise support the idea as justice, because they're going to be afraid that they're going to be asked to pay an unfair share of problems that they had no role in.
That's really interesting, Alan. Thank you. Is the task force dealing with that? And we're almost out of time, Curtis, but Alan raises an interesting question there, which is who pays if California comes up with a reparations bill from this task force? And should it fall on the general fund taxpayer or people who somehow have, you know, benefited more, however that's measured?
Yeah, I mean, that's where some of the pushback, obviously, in Sacramento came, you know, when this bill was presented in 2020. I mean, you saw, obviously, there was a lot of Republican pushback. Some Republicans obviously voted against the measure to create this task force and, you know, cited, you know, how the state would pay for this. Would this be from taxpayers? And there were concerns on that front. And, you know, even at the local air level, you know, with some of these smaller efforts, there's an effort in Hayward, California. You know, I mentioned Russell City, that was annexed by Hayward. And in 2020, last year, the city of Hayward offered a formal apology to residents of Russell City and also created kind of a smaller task force that's very local that will look at, you know, reparations for descendants of Russell City, you know, these couple hundred people who you know, several hundred people who had lost their homes. And, you know, there was local pushback basically saying that this is, you know, a quote era of social justice, and that, you know, this is not well thought out, and you know, that people shouldn't have to, you know, who weren't even living in the community then shouldn't have to, you know, essentially you know, be a part of funding any sort of reparations. Yeah. So there definitely has been pushback, but you know, all of this remains to be seen as we move into 2023 with, you know, the final recommendations that this task force will present to the state lawmakers here.
And on that last question, I mean, how serious is Governor Newsom about taking actionable steps toward reparations once the task force completes its work? Because I think it's already clear they're going to come up with some recommendations for some kind of reparations.
Yeah.
But we know that so many of the promises made by institutions and corporations in the so-called racial reckoning era post-2020 have gone unfulfilled.
Yeah, and that's a critical question. I mean, when Newsom signed this bill in 2020, he you know, released the statement really applauding it and, you know, encouraging the task force to get to work. And, you know, he lauded this as a moment of reckoning in this state. And, you know, like you said, fast forward a couple of years later now, what will the political winds look like? Is there still, you know, a vested interest from, you know, a rising Democrat in the party to really push forward with reparations? I think that remains to be seen, you know, in these months ahead, months and years ahead.
By the way, is he getting ready to run for president? We did a call in this week for Democrats asking them if they want Biden to run for re-election or not. And a lot of them did, but among those who didn't, several mentioned Gavin Newsom as an alternative. Is he laying a groundwork either for that if Biden doesn't run or for 2028, if you can look even that far ahead?
You know, I think that, you know, obviously Governor Newsom is definitely a rising star in the party. I mean, he's kind of, you know, had this elevated, you know, level of support in the party, you know, from people who are looking for an alternative to President Biden. He, you know, earlier this year kind of, you know, went around Washington and kind of did a tour meeting with, you know, lawmakers on Capitol Hill and kind of, you know, just really, you know, just kind of putting himself out there more. He faced a recall election last year here that he won, and kind of that really revitalized him and really, you know, pushed him more to the national stage. I you know, he insists obviously that he's supporting President Biden should President Biden run in 2024. But, you know, I think a lot of options are on the table for Governor Newsom.
Curtis Lee, New York Times correspondent in L.A., thanks so much for getting up early and doing this with us. Really great.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Brian.